This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Terry McMillan is a best-selling novelist who focuses on the lives, aspirations, and journeys of discovery of African-American women and their families. She hit the ground running with her first novel, Mama, in 1987, which she helped turn into a bestseller. She followed that with a series of novels that helped create a large fan base for her work. Among her best-known novels are Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back, along with Disappearing Acts, all of which were adapted for film. I interviewed Terry McMillan in the KPFA studios on February 13, 2001, while she was on tour for her fifth novel, A Day Late and A Dollar Short, a book that focuses on several members of a dysfunctional black family. The novel was adapted into a television film in 2014, starring Whoopi Goldberg and Ving Rhames, and is currently available streaming on Canopy, the free library app, as well as other streaming services. As of 2026, she has published 10 novels and 2 works of nonfiction, and is currently working as a producer, according to IMDb, on a series of TV movies titled Terry McMillan Presents. Her most recent novel, It's Not All Downhill From Here, was published in 2020.
A Day Late and a Dollar Short is a much broader canvas than your earlier works, and I'd like you to talk a little about why you attempted the saga of an entire family this time around.
I tried to write about whatever is bothering me at the time. And back in 1993, my mother was being rather nosy and seemed to always be sticking her nose in my business. My sisters and brother, she always had something to say about what we were doing and how we were living our lives. And I was really curious about if there was ever a point in time where we are seen as adults to our parents. And I just started thinking about a lot of other people. And also, I realized that my relationship with my sisters and brother was different than it used to be 20 years ago, because everybody seemed to be a little bit more secretive. People were withholding information. I wanted to explore familial relationships. What happens when one person is more successful than the other? What happens when you're the oldest versus the middle child versus being the youngest? So birth order and all of those different kinds of things. And then I just threw in things that I was always curious about, particularly a mother who is aware of an incestual relationship going on in the household, but I didn't quite take it that far. I couldn't quite go that far because I didn't find enough compassion for a mother who would sit back and allow it to go on. So I sort of had to like back up a little bit there. But basically, that's pretty much, I mean, there are a lot of different reasons. I mean, I wanted to know what it's like to be the only son in a family and household full of women. What it's like when you're a 55-year-old woman, you've been married for centuries to the same man, and he leaves you for a younger woman, and not because he's a bad person, but because basically he feels unloved and unappreciated, and she bores him.
You use several point-of-view characters. Actually, you use six point-of-view characters. Mm-hmm. The mother, Viola, matriarch, Cecil, her husband, and the three daughters, Paris, the oldest, who is a successful caterer. The middle daughter, Charlotte, who is very angry. She's married, however. She's happily married with three kids in what seems to be a fairly middle-class environment. Louis, the son, who was probably the most brilliant but also struggling the most. And Janelle, I don't know who's the youngest there.
Janelle.
Janelle is the one whose daughter is being abused. And Janelle can't quite pull it together, though, again, she's very bright. My question to you then is, in dealing with these characters, what made you decide to put it all first person and have each of them as a point of view character?
Well, my feeling is, first of all, when I wrote Mama, however many years ago it was, after having written it, I thought, gee whiz, it really would have been good to write it from everybody's point of view. But back then, I realized, one, it was the mother's story that I was more interested in telling, and two, I didn't really know if I could write it from everybody's point of view. And plus, these people were children. Well, you know, 15 or 20 years later, here I am, and I think I really love writing in first person, first of all. But the one reason that I like doing it is because it's the only way for me to be able to step outside of myself and into someone else's shoes. And I can metamorphosize myself, and I really am able to see the world through someone else's eyes. So this enabled me to do that and not be so judgmental and so prejudiced. And really, probably, I think judgmental is a better word. I was really able to sympathize with these characters without feeling sorry for them, and appreciate how they really see things without, I mean, really, as the author, I was not in this story, not at all. And that's the beauty of first person for me. I can let them tell their story, and it's almost like channeling in a way, and you become consumed by it. But it was important to me to be able to see how everybody felt about everybody else, how they saw themselves, even if it was inaccurate. Because nobody seems to see their own flaws. It's easy to point out everybody else's, but you rarely see or acknowledge your own. And that was sort of the point.
The language that they use is very different, ranging from the more, black vernacular of Charlotte and Lewis to a more cult, or even Viola, to a more cultured writing of Paris and Janelle. Did you have any difficulties with that?
No, I thought that, you know, I mean, I know all kinds of people.
Sure.
And I listen to how people talk. And plus, I mean, I can talk like this if I want to, because it's basically the way I grew up. I'm around a lot, all different kinds of people. Some people still talk this way. Even educated people that I know can speak this way. We can just drop down. Oprah does it sometimes when when she wants to drop down into her little hood thing. So it's not that hard to do. But mostly, you know, when you are to some extent educated, you just speak a little differently. That's all. You just enunciate your words a little better. You take more care.
Do you think when that happens, people who are not black treat you differently?
Well, sometimes. It depends on where you are. Of course. I mean, that's why a lot of black kids get chided to some extent in school when they say, oh, you sound like a white person. My son, he was born in New York, and the woman who used to take care of him, it was in the projects in Brooklyn. And when Solomon was about 7 or 8 and 9, each year we'd go back to the projects, and they would say, Solomon, go ahead, talk. Because, you know, he talks just like a white person. Say something, Solomon, for us. He didn't know what they were talking about. But he'd talk, and then they'd laugh, and then he'd laugh because he thought whatever he said was funny. He was stupid. But they weren't really making fun of him, but they just thought it was really weird to hear somebody that they knew speaking like this.
Terry McMillan, at times reading this, I almost felt like I was looking at a microcosm of life in Black America. Ranging from the athletic son for one daughter to the gay son for another. The girlfriend of Cecil is very much into religion at one end, and then Janelle is kind of new agey and goes to tarot readings. We have a successful marriage. We have an unsuccessful marriage. We have a policeman. How did this emerge? I'm trying to get the difference between plotting it out, working on it, and what you called before channeling the characters.
Well, I'll put it this way. You know, I did my research. I mean, I read a lot of books about mothers of incest victims, and I decided that I wanted, I mean, I did a lot of research on birth order. So there are things that I learned about being the baby of the family that they go out of their way to get attention and all this. But at the same time, I wanted to show someone who was unsure of themselves, but at the same time on a quest that she was searching. because a lot of times people don't give people like that credit. They see them as flighty, dingy, and all that. And I don't really see it that way. Not to say that they can't be dingy or flighty, but my attitude is if you're searching, you're trying to get somewhere. So I give people like that credit. And so I tried to use that. And being that she lived in California and she was the youngest and all that, I thought about other ways that she could apply things to her search. So what better than, you know, psychics and all that kind of stuff. And also, as in terms of being a perpetrator, I thought, what better than a cop, somebody you're supposed to trust on a number of different levels? Who better than a cop to do this, somebody that you would not suspect? So that's sort of the thinking that went into it. But with the Lewis character, my own brother has rheumatoid arthritis, and I stole that from him. What I really realize is this, is that, because I've read different reviews where they say it's more like a soap opera, or, you know, you pile on this and pile on that. But there are so many families, because some of this stuff I robbed. You know, I mean, I read Ann Landers and Dear Abby, and I mean, I've read a lot of this stuff. And not only that, but I know so many families that everybody has a soap opera going on in their lives. There just are. There's always at least one alcoholic. Somebody's on drugs. Somebody's marriage is breaking up. Somebody's just getting married. There's something. Everybody has issues. And the more people, more cast of characters you have, the more issues you have. And I just put them all in one family, in one book. So it may seem like a lot, but I don't think it is. I really don't think it is.
For me, as a white man reading the book, there are times when I see the black culture, parts of it that I don't know that well. And yet at the same time, there are elements that I see in various parts of my family. My mother is a middle sister with a younger and an older sister, and watching their reactions sometimes reminds me of the reactions between the sisters here. Viola, sometimes I thought she's almost too good. She knows too much.
She's not necessarily right. You know, that's the thing that I tried to portray. I think that there are a lot of parents who think that they have a handle on their kids. And when your kids get older, they still think they're who they used to be. And sure, people change. People grow up. People mature. They become adults. So the person that your parents thought you were when you were 13, you may not be the same person at 35. And so my take was that Viola's opinion is more valid to her than to anybody else. And sometimes it's inaccurate. Not all the time, but sometimes it's inaccurate. So I didn't see her as too good.
Well,
she was a bitch.
But she was certainly right on as we near the end of the book. I mean, that's very clear.
Well, the thing is that I think there are everybody has epiphanies to some extent. And you have these moments that are very cathartic, and you stop long enough and pause long enough, and then you just do this overview and you say, whoa, wait a minute. What is the whole point of all of this? And that's sort of what she did with her kids. And I think that the timing was right, and that sometimes people can say things to you that can make you feel better, that can cause you to feel relieved, and that maybe I'm not stupid, maybe I'm not crazy, maybe I'm not such a bad person after all. And what better person to tell you that than one of your parents? And I think that's the beauty of her letters and things like that. But I don't think that that puts her on the scale of being an angel, even though I loved Viola. I really did. But, you know, she had problems, too. I mean, she had problems.
I get the feeling as the book progresses that she sort of wakes up. She becomes aware of things that perhaps she wouldn't have been aware of, but they all wake up. Every single character wakes up to some degree. And I wonder if that has to do with an optimistic worldview of Terry McMillan.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a hopeful person. I'm definitely a half full glass kind of person. But I believe that fiction is an opportunity. Telling a story is an opportunity to show characters going through all the different angst of life, you know, the ups and downs, the trials. And I think that all characters are being tested, just like I think we are as human beings. We're always being tested. There are problems and issues that we're facing, and how we solve them and deal with them has a lot to do with the quality of our lives. And so in a book, I basically give characters the same kinds of problems, and how they tackle them has a lot to do with how they fare in the end. But I don't believe in fairy tales, despite what people might think in terms of Stella, because I didn't see that as one. But I don't write about passive people. I write about people who are very cognizant of the fact that something's not right in my life right now. They may not exactly be honest about what it is or what they're doing or how they're addressing it, but they know something's not right, okay, that things are a little bit off kilter. And as a result, I put them in situations where they have to deal with it, you know? So instead of Janelle just wondering if her mom and everybody is thinking that her daughter is being hit by her husband, but they're really alluding to something else, then wham, in the first chapter you find out there's something is going on and she has to see it. Now, what are you going to do about it now that you're faced with it? What are you going to do now? Okay. Well, she wasn't planning on having to do anything, but she doesn't have a choice, you know, and that's the power that I have as a writer. Okay. But in the end, all I want is my characters to feel better equipped to handle some of the problems. They aren't going to solve them all. Who does? But that in not just thinking about them, they are almost ready to try to take at least a baby step in that direction and correcting some of the wrongs or ills that they've had to deal with. That's it.
I noticed that there's a certain generosity of spirit in the book as well. There's a very moving scene where Janelle goes to visit the ex-wife of her husband, the abuser, and meets the daughter. And I'd like you to talk a little about that, because I just felt that there was a sympathy, an underlying sympathy there that was astonishing for me as a reader.
Well, it was for me too, writing it, because I didn't know. I think that, I mean, considering the fact that all of it is really made up, even the fact that Janelle's ex-husband was killed on this street, all of that. But I was like right there on that street when I was writing it. And then when she pulls up to the house and she doesn't really know what to expect. And I think she even thought she was going to feel hostility towards his ex-wife. And then she doesn't. I think she just felt it was sort of how I probably would feel had I walked into that room and saw that daughter in there. But also, I really do believe in my heart that, because I know a number of women who are victims of incest, and I've just watched turmoil and the pain that it has really caused them. In some cases, it really didn't even come out and manifest itself until they were actually adults. And in some cases, some of them are very depressed. And in some cases, some of them are eating, among other things. And it's just heartbreaking. And I think instead of giving Janelle that job that I initially had foreseen when I was reading about these mothers, I did it with his ex-wife and her daughters. And I really did sympathize with that young woman in that room. And that I made the room almost suffocatingly small and even put black towels up to the window so as not to let any light in. And she's eating cheese doodles. And, you know, she's got on a sweatsuit like she's going to go jog, and you know she's not leaving that room. And then Janelle is just very kind and understanding to her without being, she doesn't ostracize her, or I don't think judges her.
No, she doesn't. That's why I said generosity of spirit. She does not judge any of them, even mm-hmm. the woman who walks out and refuses to see her.
Yeah.
Ex-wife.
Yeah.
Among this large cast of characters, two questions. Which character did you like the best, and which character did you most identify with?
I liked Cecil and Lewis best. I thought Cecil was I thought both of them were really good men. And I think for the most part, I tried to imagine what it would be like to be, you know, 57 years old. You've worked hard. You've been a good man, a good father, a good husband. And all of a sudden you realize that your wife is fat and she's getting older and she doesn't particularly find you attractive anymore. And she makes sure you know it. You know it. And so you don't feel so good when you're around her. I thought he was very gracious in how he even handled the entire situation. I think it took a lot of courage for him to actually not go back home, you know, because he did love her, but he didn't feel loved anymore. And I was trying to imagine what that might feel like when you are facing, you know, old age and you've given your best shot to being a good father and a husband, and, you know, you realize that you might have a few good years left. What are you going to do about it? So, you know, you leave. And I didn't blame him one bit. I'd have left too. And just Lewis, just because I think that for the most part, a lot of really brilliant people have a lot of different wires crossing at the same time, and they're trying to make sure that they connect the positive with the negative so that they don't overload. And I gave him credit for trying to do that. And I think I identify mostly with Paris, obviously. I'm the oldest of five. And being one of the most successful in my family, and being a perfectionist, a control freak, bossy, all of that, I've really learned a lot as a result of writing it. So I've cut my family some slack. They're grateful because I've told them, and they were like, "Terry, we don't believe this." And I was like, "Yeah, it's me, it's me, it's me, it's me." So, and I've also cut myself some slack too.
Yeah, I wasn't going to actually say it. You sounded a little more like Paris than any of the others, but it's pretty much there. That brings up the question of the other sister, Charlotte, who as a middle child does tend to get overlooked. And she's got an anger there that none of the other characters have. And what anger did you tap into? It struck me that when you were coming from that point of view, that anger was building inside.
Well, I'll put it this way. I know a lot of people who have a lot of very hostile feelings, and it really shocked me how many people do hold grudges to family members. A lot of people, okay? And I think I sort of exaggerated the overlooking part, but I also thought that sometimes there are people in a family, one person that gets a lot of attention, and a lot of times it's the oldest or the baby, okay? And so I just wanted to know what it would feel like to feel like you were overlooked and passed over and not quite acknowledged for what your worth was. I wanted to know what that felt like because I didn't really know what it felt like. And as a result, I was getting pissed off. And I thought, and I took it a lot further in the fact that she didn't trust anybody because she got to the point where she thought everybody was out to do her in and she was always going to be one step ahead of them. And there are a lot of people out there like that, let me tell you. I've discovered a lot of people who are untrustworthy. And it's sad because it takes a lot, I think, for them to really get over this.
Terry McMillan, your books have reached a crossover audience, and so have the films, in a way that very, very few other African-American writers have achieved. Do you have any idea what it is about your work that resonates?
I don't know. I would like to think that I write about issues that most people, that a lot of people can identify with. That's the only thing I can think of. That's really pretty much it.
Your books have been turned into films.
Yes.
Have you had any input on the two theatrical releases, Waiting to Exhale or Stella, or any on the HBO film Disappearing Acts? I think it was HBO.
It was Disappearing Acts. I co-wrote the screenplays for Waiting to Exhale and Stella with Ron Bass, and I had nothing to do with HBO.
How did you feel about the final products?
HBO?
Oh, all of them. But the HBO is the most recent, yeah.
I like what they did with HBO, I mean with the Disappearing Acts HBO. I thought it was pretty good. I was moved by it, to be honest with you. I liked Stella. I liked Waiting to Exhale. But, you know, when Hollywood does something, they really polish it up and make it smooth and pretty. And they Hollywoodize the story.
Sure.
And that's what they did. I knew they were going to do it. So, I mean, I basically accepted that, you know, with Whitney Houston in the movie. And, I mean, I like Whitney Houston, don't get me wrong. But they wanted it to be an event, and Whitney made it an event. So But I was happy with both movies for the most part. But my books were meant to be read. There's a lot of things that you cannot put in a movie, and I know that, and I knew that. But I'm not knocking them. But I won't write any more adaptations.
Was it your idea to telescope the friend character who is dead at the beginning of Stella, make her live inside the context of the film and bring in other characters and puts that in her mouth?
Somebody else suggested that. I just wrote it.
That's what you're talking about, the Hollywoodization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, some people have said that the hardest thing to do is to adapt your own work because you have to spend an inordinate amount of time telescoping characters, removing characters, and removing scenes that might be your favorite scenes.
No, that wasn't. I mean, I'm aware of that. I mean, I knew that years ago. I went to film school, and I learned a lot about adaptations then. So when they bought the rights and they said, you know, because I didn't agree to write the screenplay at all when I was first approached. And as a result, I just said, no, 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 no. And then when I got talked into it, I mean, I was very, very cognizant of the fact that everything in a book cannot go on a movie. I knew that. And at the same time, you know, I know that a book is an adaptation of a book, a movie is an adaptation of a book, not the book. So I didn't have the same kind of sense of proprietary, this allegiance to everything, that I have to have everything that's in the book go in the movie, like a lot of writers do, because they feel that it won't work if you leave this out. And Hollywood is known for making things work, even without certain things that were in the book. That's just what they do. So I didn't have a problem with that at all. And plus, I've read so many stories about writers screaming and hollering and how much they hate the end product because it's not even like my book. And I see them as two separate entities completely. One is just they stole things from the book to make the movie, to remind you of the book. And that's really all it is. So I don't have a problem with that.
How about the casting?
What about the casting?
Well, particularly in Stella, were you satisfied with Angela Bassett? I know my my sister complained and said she was absolutely the wrong person for the role. I like her, but...
No, I thought Angela was great. I thought she was great. I loved her. I mean, she's 40 years old. I think Angela's sexy. I thought she was good. Your sister's the first one I've heard complain about old Angela.
Well, my sister complains about a lot of things, but that's a completely different family relationship. That's an older and a younger going at it. As I said before, there were times when I saw more of Black America than merely family, and I was struck reading A Day Late and A Dollar Short about how the Black experience impacts, or I guess any ethnic experience impacts a family, any family. I mean, my family's Jewish, and that impacts. I've got the generation coming over, great-grandparents and grandparents, how it impacts the first-generation American and the second. So obviously every family is impacted. One thing it struck me is that in a lot of families, mine included, there's the class struggle comes out. The poorer people in the family get short shrift as opposed to the wealthier ones. And I'm curious, I didn't see that much of it here. Is that different in the Black family than, say, you know, the Jewish family?
No, I don't think so. I think it is in this story. But I don't think that it's as pronounced. I mean, it doesn't come out of their mouths as much. I think Lewis says it best. You know, he says, just because I don't make the kind of money that my other two sisters make and I don't live in a big house, you know, they think that I don't really have it together, which to some extent is true, but he's basing it upon the fact that they have a larger income, a steady income. I think that he thinks that they judge him for that reason, which to some extent is true. But everybody does in America. Right. Everybody. It's not just a racial issue. I think everybody judges you on how well you fare in this world. If you can pay your bills and if you can afford a vacation after you pay your bills, You know, if you can drive a decent car, it doesn't have to be a Mercedes, but just a car that runs. And in the black community, I think it garners a different kind of respect, or at least people take notice. And I think that's one reason why so many of the hip hoppers and the rappers, which I guess are the same thing, if you look in all of their videos, you only see them drive Mercedes. And they are so pronounced and so highly visible. And everybody's in Versace, you know. Everybody wears Versace or nothing but the best of everything. And they want you to know that we've got good taste, we're flaunting it, we can afford it, and we're doing it there.
It almost seems like a reaction to an inferiority complex.
No, I don't think it's that at all. I think for the most part, when we were growing up as black people, my mother, even though we didn't have any money, my mother taught us, and a lot of black families do teach you this, that just because you're poor, you don't have to look poor. So as a result, a lot of black families, a lot of children growing up, and to some extent impoverished conditions, if you have parents that care, they don't. If they buy you inexpensive things, you won't know it's cheap. Socks are going to be white. Your skirt, dress, pants are going to be pressed and ironed and starched. You're going to look clean. And as a result of being taught this, even myself, before I even had any money, my mother used to say, never buy cheap things. Always buy good quality because it will last longer. And if you buy it, buy cheap stuff, you end up buying it two and three times. So just spend the money the first time. And really, I think to some extent, that's what's underneath it. I don't think it's an inferiority complex at all. But also, they're just showboats. They're just flashy. These are kids doing this stuff, you know, and they're stupid. They don't know any different. But a lot of it also has to do with the way that we were taught. That's why you see a lot of black kids when they grow up. I mean, the first thing, all these athletes, they don't go out and buy a rabbit. They go and buy a BMW, a Mercedes, and then if they're really nuts, they go for the Lamborghinis, and that's when they're flashing. But no, You know, they might buy a 10,000 square foot house when a 4,000 will do. But for the most part, it's because they know and have paid attention. They know the value of things. And it's like, why not buy a Mercedes? Because it's not going to depreciate as much as if I buy that, I don't want to say Lexus, but you know.
Who do you think has it rougher these days, the black man or the black woman?
I think both. For different reasons. Definitely for different reasons. I think that black women, I think, are still stuck raising a lot of kids by ourselves, due in part to the fact that there are a lot of young black men and black men in general who still are like Lewis, who are sort of in limbo. They're searching for a place, and there's some who are just confused. There's some who are lost. There's some who are victims of a whole lot of stuff. Racism is one. And then there are some that I think just got off on the wrong foot, you know, that haven't paid attention to the strikes that are already set up against them and have fallen victim to it. Because even a lot of these rappers and stuff and a lot of the gangbangers out here, I really believe in my heart that if they really knew, if they were really, really aware of what Malcolm X was talking about 30 years ago, and Dr. Martin Luther King, that they would be ashamed of themselves for some of the stuff that they're doing to each other. Because even though they are purporting that the white man is still killing us and bringing drugs and guns into our neighborhoods and doing all these things, nobody's doing anything more to us than we are doing to ourselves. And a lot of these young men are the ones out here who have babies, you know, like that young football player who had his girlfriend killed because she was pregnant by his baby, or supposedly. I don't know how true it is, but he didn't want her. He didn't want to pay child support. I don't know how true that is either, to be honest with you. But my point is I wish that a lot of the young men out here could rap and do their thing and be who they are without degrading each other, without degrading black women, and without killing each other. I wish they could really see how stupid it is. You know, to make records where they brag about calling each other names. I mean, calling each other the N-word, which I cannot say, and MF this and MF that. I don't even understand what makes them think I don't even know who they're trying to impress. You know what I mean? It's just really heartbreaking. And I think that there are a lot of women out here who really see through a lot of what's going on. And that's why we spend an inordinate amount of time trying to make sure that our children are educated, that they are not influenced by a lot of the gang banging, that we get them out of neighborhoods where they have to be afraid and all that. And it's usually the mothers that are doing that. It's the mothers that drag the kids to school, to Little League, to soccer practice, that make sure they're fed and clothed and all that. That's what we do.
I keep looking at our society and I keep going, well, why haven't we achieved that we should have achieved by now? I mean, we've had 50 years since people really began waking up about racism in this country. And sometimes I feel we haven't gone anywhere near as far as we should have for both whites and blacks.
I don't know to some extent if that's really ever going to change anytime, at least not anytime soon. It's unfortunate. I think that like my son's generation, my son is 16. I think that each generation, I think, gets better. I also think that with the Rebecca Walkers of the world, with a lot of mixed race children, I think that's going to help a lot because there are a lot of mixed race children out here who don't fit in on one side or the other. And I, when it comes to race too, I'm so tired of everybody assuming that everything is all black and white. It's almost as if other ethnic groups don't exist, you know? And I mean, lately, you know, I've met so many Indian people, you know, Persian. I know all kinds of people. You know, I was jogging in my neighborhood the other day and I'm running with this woman who's Armenian and I didn't even know she was Armenian. And they're getting ready to put on their first opera in San Francisco. And I never even thought about an Armenian opera before. You know, and I mean, this is like her world and it's important to her. And I'm saying to myself, you know, everybody is valid. You know, and I'm reading now The Death of Vishnu. And I'm saying to myself, these people live in this apartment building in Bombay. This is their world. And it is valid to them. Everybody's world is valid. And I think until we get to that point, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And basically realize that we're all struggling for the same thing, which is respect and love and peace of mind. That's the only time when I think we'll be better off. I mean, I think there are a lot of people out here that do realize it. But I don't think that there's ever going to be some utopia. We can forget about that.
How will we reach a point where cultures and races are totally respected among?
Well, I think that we're heading in that direction. We really are. And again, I do think that mixed race children have a lot to do with it because there are millions of them. And when you start to realize that everything is part of a whole and that God created all of us, who cares what color you are, really? You know, I mean, when my son was smaller, I used to say to him, and I didn't say it jokingly, I used to say, you know, when you grow up, I just want you to know, mommy doesn't care what color your girlfriend is or if he's a boy, you know, as long as he's not dumb. You know, that's the only thing I beg of you. Please don't let him or her be dumb. You know, that's all I ask. They don't have to be pretty. Just don't let them be dumb, you know, and I meant it. Sort of. A little cute wouldn't hurt, but.
What does Terry McMillan have next? I noticed you take about 4 years between books. Have you started work on
that? No, I've only taken that long for this one. You know, I have a couple of novels that are both kind of scratching at the door, so to speak, but I wanted to take a little bit of time after the book came out to exhale, I guess, and read, because I don't read a lot when I'm writing. And there are a lot of books that I'm backed up, and I really want to read them. And there are some good books out here, and I've been collecting them for a couple of years, and I'm going to read them. So I'm not the only writer out here, and I don't read my own books when they come out. So thank God there are a lot of other fine, fine writers out here. So that's what I'm going to do right now. And hopefully, I mean, I'm going to write my 40 pages in the next few months, and but take a little bit more time. It won't be 4 years for the next one, though.
Terry McMillan's next novel, The Interruption of Everything, actually was published 4 years later in 2005. And as said at the outset, a television film adaptation of A Day Late and A Dollar Short, which was originally aired on the Lifetime Network in 2014, is now available streaming through Canopy, the free library app, and Amazon Prime. You've been listening to an archive interview with novelist Terry McMillan, recorded in the KPFA studios on February 13, 2001, while she was on tour for her fifth novel, A Day Late and A Dollar Short. This interview was digitized, remastered, and edited in March 2026, and has not been heard in over 20 years. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.